So obviously I'm not here to talk about hockey or baseball or any sport at all. I'm here to talk about exchange. So I'm working with a consultant company in Sweden, and we have done some migrations during this first year of Exchange Server 2013. And what I would like to do here today in roughly an hour is to share our experiences that we have had during these migrations. So especially there are some pitfalls in an immigration to Exchange Server 2013 that I would like to share and also show some of them, and hopefully we will make a solution to them as well. Okay, so my name is Henrik Garpenrud. That's a hard name to pronounce, huh? So the American people, they usually say Garpenrud or Garpenrud, and I kind of like that. So, but I figured I would explain myself as the real Swedish pronunciation here today, but yeah, so that's who I am. So I work out of Sweden. We work with Exchange, we work with Lync, and also Office 365. And as you can see, I'm a certified master in Exchange, and have been so since 2011. So starting to be considered a dinosaur, I think, especially since Microsoft retired that program last year. Boo. So the agenda. This is what we're going to look at today. And the most important part of this agenda, I would say, is what pitfalls there are in this migration to Exchange Server 2013. So this is where I will spend the most time, I guess. So, and also, as you can see, I put in some time in the end for Q&A. So hopefully we can stay with our questions till then. And I will be happy to stay here as long as you want and answer all your questions. Okay. So first of all, to kind of set the stage, to get us all on the same page, I would like to talk about some of the limitations and challenges that we have or had in Exchange Server 2007 and 2010. So you could see this as reasons to move away from those legacy versions of Exchange, I would say. And this was also reasons for many of our customers to move away from this product and move to 2013. So first of all, we need to think about when Exchange Server 2007 was released. That's like 7 years ago. That's quite some time ago. And the previous version before 2007 was 2003. And we had two server roles, and we had a 32-bit architecture back then. And it was kind of hard to design Exchange for large organizations because we had really constraints on the CPU and the memory and this 32-bit architecture. So when Microsoft released Exchange Server 2007, they had five new server roles. Three of them were kind of mandatory, and we know them as Mailbox, CAS, and Hub. So we had to deploy those, and we could deploy unified messaging in Edge as well if you wanted to. So then Exchange 2010 arrived, and we still had these five server roles. So this was kind of kept from 2007. But early in the life cycle of 2010, Microsoft did recommend multi-role servers. So because 3 years had passed and the hardware was more efficient, we had faster processors, and RAM prices was going down. So the recommendation early in the life cycle of 2010 was to use multi-role servers, meaning, say, we do the Mailbox server, the CAS server, and the Hub Transport server on the same box. So that was the recommendation. So when we look at 2013, it's quite natural that Microsoft recommended multi-role servers earlier. But let's wait with that a little bit. So tightly coupled. So what do we mean by this? You see this a lot when Microsoft is doing presentations. So it kind of, you know, gets stuck in my head as well. So I use the same terminology. Yeah, you heard the word. So what we mean with this is that all these server roles in Exchange 2007 and 2010, they had to be tied together. So all the traffic between these server roles was mainly RPC traffic. And you all know that RPC traffic isn't that WAN friendly. So we want to keep that on the LAN. And because of this, we said that the roles were tightly coupled together, and there were RPC traffic going in between the server roles. Namespaces. So how many of you in here think it's kind of fun to deploy certificates and namespaces and so on? How many thinks it's fun? Okay, like two. So you will be glad when you start to deploy Exchange Server 2013, because it's much, much easier. So this was a pain in 2010. It wasn't uncommon to have like 10 SAN names on a any given certificate for a 2010 deployment. Especially when you do the site resilience setup, it was kind of tricky to plan for all these namespaces. RPC Client Access Array. So this was something that was introduced in Exchange 2010. So we have this RPC Client Access Service. So that's the service that Outlook always has connected to connect into the mailbox. So in Exchange 2007, Outlook connected directly to the mailbox server. So if we had the CCR cluster, for example, we had two nodes, and the RPC service, so to speak, was running on one of these nodes. And if the server failed, we failed over the service to the other server. And we had long failover times from a client perspective in 2007. So this was one of the reasons that this service was moved to the client access role in Exchange 2010. And also something that was needed to be able to build these DAGs with more than two mailbox cluster nodes. So this was a good thing, right? We were very happy about this when Exchange 2010 was released. But it was still a challenge because we had this CAS server as the middle tier, basically, so client, CAS, mailbox. And it was RPC traffic going from the client to the CAS server and also down to the mailbox server. And this was especially a problem when we had site resilience setups. So when we did disaster recovery, this was a big concern for us. And it also introduced the requirement of a layer 7 load balancer. So this was kind of tricky. We are all Exchange administrators, I guess, in here. So we are not experts in load balancing. But when we started to deploy Exchange Server 2010, we had to be. Because we had to know about this stuff as called persistence, affinity, and cookies, and SSL IDs. It was a lot of things we had to think about. And this was complex and a pain for many, many customers. Like I said a little bit about disaster recovery, this was also complex and a pain for us to design in Exchange Server 2007. It was very manual with SCR. I still miss that feature, though. How many are with me? How many miss SCR? Yeah, I see Kai misses it and someone else. Yeah, so because this was very flexible, this thing. So we actually did a migration once for a customer. They had a very short amount of time, and they needed to move like several thousands of mailboxes from Sweden to Amsterdam. And we figured we didn't have the time to move it over the network. So we actually took an mailbox server, put the SCR copy of the database there, drive down to Amsterdam with that server, and then activated that SCR copy. And the good thing with SCR was that it wasn't part of the cluster. It was a standalone server. It could be a cluster of its own, but it was still a standalone server. So that made it easy. So the DAG doesn't have that flexibility. So, but still, my point with this bullet is that everything when it comes to disaster recovery is meant to be a manual process in 2007 and 2010 as well. So there were some bright minds that, you know, scripted a lot of things and so on in Exchange 2010. They utilized the third witness sites already in 2010. But that was not the design from Microsoft, basically. It was always meant to be a manual process. Okay, so that was the history. That was the pain, the limitations and challenges that we had in the old product. It was kind of reasons to move away from those versions and go to 2013. So what has changed considering these different topics? So first of all, you might have heard. First, how many were attending the Microsoft Exchange conference in Austin a month ago? Okay, that's just a few. Good. How many have seen Ross Smith's presentation on Exchange Server 2013 architecture? Just a few as well. That's good. So in Exchange Server 2013, we now only have three server roles instead of the previous five. And the important thing here is that the previous three roles called Client Access, Hub Transport, and Mailbox, they are all now being one server role. So you can think of the new mailbox role in 2013 as a 2010 multi-role server. And you also add unified messaging to that mailbox server. So 2010 versions of mailbox, CAS, hub, and UM are now 2013 mailbox. So the new CAS role in 2013, that's a brand new role. It was nothing like that in Exchange 2010 or 2007. So this is basically a proxy server, and we call it a stateless proxy server, which means it doesn't keep a state for the sessions. So the easiest way to think about that is if you think about SMTP. So CAS in 2013 is also an SMTP proxy, and it doesn't keep a queue for the messages. So think of it like that. Doesn't keep a queue for the message. That's an easy way to understand how a stateless proxy works. And then we have Edge. And Edge in 2013, since Service Pack 1 we have Edge, I should say, that's still Edge. Okay, one more Microsoft term. Every server is an island. And I kind of like this as well, because you remember a couple of slides ago, a couple of minutes ago, I said that we were tightly coupled in Exchange Server 2007 and 2010. And we had a lot of RPC traffic going on between the server roles. So in 2013, we don't do that anymore. So every server is an island if you think about RPC. So you will never see RPC traffic going on between the different server roles in Exchange Server 2013. The RPC traffic always happens within that local server. So let's take an example. If you are an Outlook client, and Outlook clients in 2013 always use HTTPS, so when you use Exchange 2013, you will do Outlook Anywhere even internally. So that session will hit the CAS server in 2013, this stateless proxy server. And this proxy server will take a look at that package that's coming in and see, hey, who is this session for? It's for Bob. Okay, Bob. Where is Bob's mailbox? So Bob's mailbox is mounted on server A, mailbox server A, let's say that. So then CAS will do a proxy to that mailbox server. And then on that server, the RPC traffic will be handled locally on that mailbox server. So in Exchange 2010, you could hit one CAS, and your mailbox could be on another mailbox server, and you will have RPC traffic between that CAS server and the mailbox server. And that will never happen now in 2013, because RPC will always be on the server where your mailbox is mounted. Make sense? Okay. That's good. So these new roles and these new concept of every server is an island makes load balancing and namespace planning much, much easier. Because we are actually doing some kind of load balancing in CAS, some kind of load balancing logic. So the layer 7 load balancer we had before, we took some part of that and moved it to the CAS server, you can say. And therefore, you can do a simpler load balancing in front of the CAS servers. So there, when Exchange Server 2013 was released, there were rumors or talk around this area, and they said, you don't need a load balancer anymore in Exchange Server 2013. You can do DNS round robin. And you could, but it's not that good, because it doesn't give you any server availability at all. The server has to be completely down for the client to try the next server. And that's kind of bad if you know lose one service on a server, or it maybe just hangs, the operating system hangs, but it still responds to TCP, then it will still try that server, the Outlook client. So that's not good. So, but you can do layer 4 load balancing. You can still do layer 7 load balancing if you want per protocol availability. And you can do that with layer 4 as well with a namespace per protocol. But it's much, much easier now. Automatic site failover. Maybe the number one reason my customers moved to Exchange Server 2013. They wanted to accomplish automatic site failover. So we can do that with Exchange Server 2013. And it's once again this new CAS proxy server and the new concept of every server is an island. That's what makes this possible. So without that concept, we cannot do automatic site failover. So the thing you do when you do automatic site failover in 2013 is that you set up two sites, for example. You put servers in each site. You will have active mailboxes in each site. You will have CAS servers and mailbox servers in each site. And then you will do DNS round robin between these sites. And some might think, hey, did he say DNS round robin? He just said that that wasn't good. So we can do that between sites, but not within the site, basically. So between sites, it makes more sense. Because think of it, you are hitting a load balancer in a different site. And what you want to accomplish in that scenario is that if that site goes completely down, you want automatic failover to the other site. And that will happen because all those servers and load balancers and everything will be gone when that site is gone. So that's what you do. So you will do DNS round robin between your two sites, your two CAS arrays, basically, that you have load balancing in front of. Or you can do GeoDNS if you want to optimize that structure. And the critical part here from a cluster perspective is that you need a third witness site for the file share witness. So, and this is something you could do in Exchange 2010 as well, but Microsoft recommended against it. And the reason is that the client access part of Exchange 2010 required us to move that client access array namespace between the two different sites. So, and since we don't have a client access array namespace anymore, we can do automatic site failover. Improved handling of lag copies. So this is maybe not an architecture thing, but it's a nice feature which I like, and it's important for many of our customers. So I thought I will, you know, say something about it. So in 2010, you could use lag copies, but they were kind of left alone. They were sitting there, and if you, for example, encountered low disk space, the disk got full, the lag copy would be corrupt. Or, for example, it needed a page patch. There was something wrong in the database. We needed to patch that page. It was corrupt. So those two things we can configure. So if any of those two things occur, we will have an automatic play down of the log files. So we will still have a healthy copy. We will lose the lag, obviously, but still it will be a healthy copy. And then my favorite, less than three other healthy copies. This is something you can configure. You can say less than two other healthy copies, for example, or four, or whatever you want. So I like this one. So think of this preferred architecture that Microsoft showed us a couple of weeks ago on the ELO blog. So you have the two servers in site A and two servers in site B. And one of the copies in site B have a lag copy. So when everything is up and running, you have three HA copies, normal copies, so to speak, and then one lag copy. So what if you lose one of those sites? Then you will end up having one HA copy and one lag copy, right, if you lose site A. And that might be a problem for you, because especially maybe you are doing JBOD, you're doing no RAID. So in that scenario, you could have the replay lag manager to automatically play down the log files of that lag copy, and therefore you have two HA copies, for example. So, and I will show you another example in a bit with this. Okay. So why did my customers or our customers migrate to Exchange Server 2013? I gave you some hints already, like the automatic site failover, but this is a huge thing, large mailboxes. So you all know about Office 365. We can get 50 gig mailboxes in Office 365 for nothing, right? So how do we, I'm not saying we should compete with that, but if you think of a local organization that want to keep Exchange locally, and they provide their users 2 gig mailboxes, and they hear, the IT manager hears about Office 365, they could get 50 gig mailboxes. I want to do that as well. Of course. Why shouldn't you? Why should you have 2 gig of mailboxes locally when you can get 50 in Office 365? You should obviously move to Office 365. Or you should design your Exchange 2013 deployment to actually handle these large mailboxes at a very low cost. And the only way to do that, it is to use JBOD, no RAID, to do 7.2K drives, to do multiple copies per JBOD volume, to do Exchange native data protection with lag copies and don't do traditional backups. So that's the only way we can provide those large mailboxes that are low cost that could compete with Office 365. So this is a huge thing for customers that moved to Exchange 2013 for us. And this is like the first thing we start to take the discussion with when we discuss this with our customers. Automatic site failover, we already talked about that. Maybe the number one feature that made our customers move to 2013. One global namespace. So this was kind of tricky to do in Exchange 2010. And it's much, much easier now thanks to this new CAS architecture. So we can have mail.contoso.com and we can have data centers in Europe, in Asia, and North America. And we can use GeoDNS to optimize that first initial connection into Exchange. Much, much easier now thanks to the stateless proxy we have in CAS. The new role design I talked about, every server is an island. It makes the environment robust. So I have one particular customer who has offices like everywhere, a couple of hundred of offices around the world. And it's like crazy exotic places where, you know, 1 megabit connection is very, very expensive. This is a good thing for them, as they think, you know, everything is HTTPS, a more robust design. And if we talk about the new MAPI HTTP, which was introduced in Service Pack 1, it's even more robust. DLP. So how many have heard about DLP? Okay. So did you see the DLP session? All of you that were, yeah, you're nodding. Okay. That's good. I will not talk too much about this. So basically you can say that for you that didn't raise your hand, DLP is a system that can help us to identify sensitive information that is being sent or on the way to being sent. We could report on that information. We could block that information. We can educate the user by policy tips, things like that. So customers who are like in healthcare, for example, they are very keen about this because then you can prevent, you know, sensitive secret information to being leaked out of your exchange environment. So huge killer feature. Obviously, some customers just want to move forward to the next version. Nothing wrong about that. And like I said, lag copies. So I had one customer who had one data center with 3 copies of their exchange data doing JBOD, but one of those copies was lagged, so it was only 2 HA copies. And that is maybe fine, but what if you lose one of those HA copies? You only have 1 HA copy left and 1 lag copy. Then they were concerned. So maybe this was not the ideal design, to be honest, but with help of this, they could live with that. Because then they will lose the lag if they lose 1 HA copy, but that's fine. And then they still have high availability on their normal copies. Okay. So anyone interested in how you migrate? Okay, some of you. So this will be just like an overview. Because there was another session which was focused on migrating. So first of all, we need to prepare. So let's say we have Exchange Server 2010 or 2007 in our existing environment. So the first thing I want you to do is to set your offline address books. And I will talk more about this in a bit in our next slide. Not the next slide, but in a couple of slides. But this is an important one, so take a note of this in your head. Then if you are migrating from Exchange Server 2007, you need to create a legacy namespace. So this is exactly the same as you did when you migrated from Exchange Server 2007 to 2010. It's basically the same as you do in 2013. You need to verify that you have the correct builds on all your existing servers. So these builds were released a year ago, so probably you are on those builds. But that's an important thing. And then obviously you need to prepare your schema and your Active Directory and so on. So this is the preparation part. No install yet. This is just doing stuff with your existing environment. Then you do the install, and I want to clear that out. I should have done that earlier. You should run the mailbox server and the CAS server together. So we still recommend multi-role servers, or Microsoft still recommend multi-role servers. So, but if you for some reason want to have them apart, you should install mailbox first. So first install mailbox, and then you install CAS. But you should really put them together. So there's really no reason to keep them apart. So, and then you have the configuration part. And I would like to say that during a migration, most of the configuration that is migration related, that's when it comes to CAS. So all these virtual directories, the external URL, internal URL, namespaces, certificates, all those things still matters, even if we have less namespaces to think about now than we had in the past. Then we have this funny bullet, enable Outlook Anywhere on all legacy servers. That's kind of funny, huh? So previously in 2010 and 2007, you enabled Outlook Anywhere on your internet-facing CAS servers. That's what you did, not on the non-internet-facing CAS servers. So in 2013, we need to do that on all your legacy servers or when you are migrating to 2013. And this is if you are using Outlook Anywhere, obviously. So if you're not using it, you don't need to enable it on your legacy servers. But if you are using it, you need to enable it on all legacy servers. And the reason for this is that the CAS server in 2013 does a proxy to the legacy CAS server. So we need to have Outlook Anywhere there because there's no Outlook Anywhere rendering going on the CAS 2013 server. It will proxy to the 2007 or the 2010 CAS server for Outlook Anywhere. So therefore, you need to enable it. And you need to put your, you know, normal host name there. So don't put server FQDN or something, because AutoDiscover will look on that Outlook Anywhere reader and send that to the client. So the proxy will still be to the server FQDN. So, but you will put like mail.contoso.com on your Outlook Anywhere hostname on your legacy servers, all of them, unless you have two different or three different ingress points for Outlook Anywhere. AutoDiscover, kind of important. So your SCP, your service connection points, and your DNS should all point to Exchange 2013. So this is important, because otherwise the 2007 and 2010 servers will try to redirect AutoDiscover to the 2013 server, and that will kind of work internally, but not externally. So your DNS and your SCPs should all point to Exchange Server 2013 before you start migrating users. And then it's obviously time to switch over the namespace from the legacy servers to the 2013 servers. So this is where you move your DNS records. And then you switch over transport, your inbound and outbound emails, and then you start moving mailboxes. So that's basically the steps involved, high level. And then we do cleanup. So we install our uninstall our legacy servers and our third-party systems. Okay. So now we have some nasty pitfalls here. Some more or less nasty. So first of all, kind of normal stuff, but still it's kind of a pitfall, because you could fall into it if you don't know about this legacy server. You have heard all about this proxying going on in Exchange 2013. Maybe you think it proxies to 2007 as well. But it doesn't, not for everything. So we have this environment here with Exchange Server 2007. We have a legacy URL that we published and created and pointed out to our 2007 environment. We cut over our namespaces, the mail.contoso.com and autodiscover.contoso.com, to Exchange Server 2013 CAS. Okay? So how will now these different CAS protocols work? First of all, OWA. Outlook Web App, it will redirect to the legacy server. But it's a single sign-on redirect nowadays, which is really nice. So the user only has to sign in once. So he will sign in to the 2013 form, and he will get the 2007 OWA. And I will show you that in the demo as well. AutoDiscover in 2013 handles AutoDiscover for 2007 mailboxes. So, but it will hand out the legacy URL for EWS and OAB. So it will look on the external URL for EWS and OAB on the 2007 CAS servers and hand that out to mailboxes running on 2007. But it's AutoDiscover in 2013 that will give the user the URLs. Outlook Anywhere, POP, and IMAP will be proxied. So, and it will be proxied from the 2013 CAS server to the 2007 CAS server. And that's why you need Outlook Anywhere enabled on the 2007 CAS server. And all of them. And then Exchange Active Sync. So geeks like me think that it's kind of interesting to see that the proxy going on here is from 2013 CAS to 2013 mailbox and then to 2007 CAS. Kind of strange, huh? But that's what's happening for Exchange Active Sync. And here's a table for your reference, which you can look at later, because this slide will obviously be available to download. How about 2010? Much easier. So, no legacy URL. We only have the 2010 servers, and we cut over our namespace to 2013. And everything will be proxy to 2010 CAS. Easy. One thing I want to highlight is that this includes AutoDiscover. So in 2007, mailboxes were handed AutoDiscover response from the 2013 servers, like I said. But this is not the case with 2010. So CAS 2013 will proxy the AutoDiscover response to CAS in 2010. And 2010 CAS will give the AutoDiscover response. So that's kind of strange. Otherwise, everything is just proxy. Okay, how about this one? So, this is maybe the nastiest pitfall that I would like to point out of all these pitfalls we have here in the migration. It shouldn't really occur for everyone because normally you set your OABs, but it could happen. It's really something you really need to look for, especially if you have a large environment. So you could end up with the WAN being utilized with 99% if you don't plan for this carefully. And the reason for this is that when you install your first 2013 server, it will create a new offline address book, a new OAB. And this is a brand new version of the OAB. And if a user gets a new OAB version, it will be a full download of the OAB. And if you don't set your offline address book on your legacy mailbox databases, if you have that blank like this, which is the default, so if you guys installed 2010 a couple of years ago, you didn't think about this, you just installed them, everything works, you might have a situation where it looks like this. And you install your 2013 servers, and all your users will download that new full OAB. And that could be a problem. So therefore, I would like you to verify that you have an OAB set in all your legacy mailbox databases before you introduce your first 2013 server. There is a full download, though, when the users are migrated, and that one you cannot avoid. But that might not be a problem because you will move people in batches, right? So, but plan for that as well, especially if you have large OABs with, you know, pictures and certificates and a lot of stuff in. So this applies to both 2007 and 2010 migration. It's the same. So important in both of these migrations. Okay, how about this one? How many here uses Outlook 2007 in their environment? Okay, maybe 10% or so. So this one is for you. So it happens from time to time that you need to modify, you know, folder permissions. For example, calendar permissions. You want to, you know, give someone reviewer permissions or full access in your calendars. You ever do that? Yeah. So when doing this with Outlook 2007, when your mailbox is on Exchange Server 2013, this will throw an error. It's a nasty one saying, an error occurred setting scheduled permissions. Okay? So if you have a fully patched environment, like Exchange Server 2013 SP1 and a fully patched Outlook, it actually works nowadays. But this wasn't the case like 2 months ago. Then it didn't work. The setting didn't apply. So it's better now, but to make sure that your Outlook is fully patched before you roll out Exchange Server 2013 for your users. But they will still get this error. Even if it works, they will get this error. And that might be a concern for you. So upgrade Outlook. Applies to both migrations because Exchange isn't involved in this one. Not the legacy Exchange, at least. So how about this one? Shared mailboxes. So all of my customers use shared mailboxes. They use resource mailboxes. They use shared mailboxes, etc. So if you are migrating user mailboxes to 2013 and they are accessing shared mailboxes in the legacy environment, either 2007 or 2010, they will be asked for credentials. And when you enter those credentials, doesn't help. Wow. So Exchange Server 2013 has a default authentication method for clients being negotiate on the Outlook Anywhere vendor. So, and since everything is Outlook Anywhere, as soon as you are moved to 2013, this will affect those users. And as soon as you, as long as you have negotiate on those Outlook Anywhere vendors, you will have this problem with shared mailboxes. So you need to change your Outlook Anywhere authentication method in 2013 to NTLM or Basic. If you use that, your user won't like that internally, but NTLM is probably the way to go. So you need to do that, and then it will work. So Exchange Server 2013 SP1 gives us a nice warning, though, when we are on that window and fiddling with this, if we're using the GUI. So it warns us about it, but that wasn't the case before Service Pack 1. So still important to change that to NTLM. And I will show you this in the demo as well, and hopefully it will work. Okay, applies to both 2007 and 2010 migrations. How about this one? Ambiguous URL. This is kind of nasty as well. So we have an existing environment here. We have Exchange 2010. So this only applies to Exchange 2010. We have an RPC client access array. And we decided to name this CAS array mail.contoso.com. So we use the same name as we do for Outlook Web App and ActiveSync and everything. It's kind of neat, you know, to have one URL for everything. Okay? Anyone uses it like this? Okay. Then this one is for you. So what happens when we move DNS? So we switch over our namespace, our external, you know, HTTPS namespace, because that's what it is for us, Outlook Web App and everything. We need to move that to 2013 before we start migrating users for this to work, the stuff I showed you earlier with proxy and redirect and everything. So what will happen? Yeah, so this mailbox we have here on the right side, which is on 2010, will try to go and talk RPC with the CAS in 2013. So anyone think that will work? No. CAS 2013 doesn't talk RPC. It's an HTTPS proxy. That's what it does. So when the client comes there with its RPC packets, it won't work. So you will have a problem. So there are some ways to solve this. Obviously, you can do it on the load balancer. But there are also some things you can do in Exchange to solve this. But it needs to be solved. And I will show you this in a demo as well. So the first thing would be to change your CAS array FQDN. So that's a pain because it's a lot of user impact. We need to change the RPC client access server attribute on all your mailbox databases in Exchange 2010. And then you need to do a little thing, you know, repair Outlook profile on all Outlook clients. So maybe it works if you have 20, but if you have 20,000, it's going to be a problem. So the thing that I would recommend is to do this. And this is what we will try in the lab, in the demo as well. So we will force the Exchange Server 2010 clients' mailboxes to use RPC over HTTPS before we switch the namespace to Exchange Server 2013. So in that way, the 2010 mailboxes will hit the CAS 2013 with HTTPS instead of RPC, and it will proxy the connection to CAS in 2010, and it will work. Make sense? So this applies to Exchange Server 2010 migrations. And there's an awesome blog article written by Brian Day on this specific problem. So you can read more about it there. OK, Outlook Anywhere namespace. So split DNS is good. I like split DNS. I recommend that for all my customers. So if you do link, you kind of have to do some kind of split DNS, at least use pinpoint zones. And when you go Exchange Server 2013, it's a really good idea to do split DNS as well, because we really don't have any namespaces anymore that is kind of like, you know, Active Directory bound, because everything is HTTPS. So why not use, you know, external namespaces, if you want to call them that, even internally? There is one problem, though. It is with Outlook Anywhere. So if you are using different authentication methods for Outlook Anywhere internally and externally, this is going to be a problem for you. So this is the exception to use the exact same host name internally and externally. So the reason for this is that Outlook will always try the internal Outlook Anywhere settings received from AutoDiscover first. So a 2013 mailbox we'll get an AutoDiscover response containing several, or two actually, Outlook Anywhere host names. And if those two are the same, you know, you use mail.contoso.com, both internally and externally, that's fine as long as you have the same authentication method working. But if you have, like in this picture, you're doing a reverse proxy with basic authentication, and the client is trying to go there with NTLM because that's the first answer in the AutoDiscover response, which is the internal settings, it won't work. So therefore, the recommendation is, especially if you're doing different authentications, to do mail int or mail ext or whatever, you know, two different namespaces for Outlook Anywhere in 2013. So one external and one internal. So you can think of it, if you want to, as, you know, the RPC client access array name. That's what you could use for internal. Not that exact name, but the same thinking around it. Yeah, use different namespaces. Okay, this one. This is fun. So, hey, this guy, this Exchange consultant, he's saying that we should use local 7.2K drives. He's saying we shouldn't use RAID. He's saying we should do like multiple databases on same drive. He's crazy. We should use our SAN. We should use fiber channel drives. You know, it's a database. Exchange uses a database. That's critical for the drives, you know. Anyone recognize this? Yeah, okay, I see some nodding. That's good. So this is really fun discussions. And usually it's kind of hard to have these discussions. You could explain how it works. You know, we have multiple copies of the data. We're doing our RAID 5 on Exchange application level. We don't lose any IOPS because we don't use RAID, so therefore we can use all the IOPS that the disk gives us, stuff like this. That's okay. The storage team will obviously understand that because they know storage, but still, no, crazy. We cannot do that. Okay, so how can we solve this? So it's not an easy task, obviously. And sometimes I lose, I need to be honest. Sometimes I lose, and I don't like that. I don't like losing, you know? So what we tend to do is, because this is all about cost, so I want my customers to have large mailboxes. That's what I want, because otherwise it will be a pain for them to keep those mailboxes at a small size. So and the only way they can have large mailboxes is to use local drives, to use this new structure without RAID, et cetera. So we need to take this discussion at a higher level. That's my experience, at least. So to show the management what money they are saving by using this new architecture and showing references at other customers that are doing like this. So that's what I think, at least. Okay, legacy public folders. And this is not about migrating public folders, because there was a specific migrating public folders session. But there are some pitfalls when it comes to public folders. So what if you keep your public folders on your legacy servers, because maybe you need the public folder replication that isn't there in 2013 or some other reason, because there are many limitations in public folders in 2013. With number of items, number of folders, it isn't ready, to be honest. So if you are using EWS clients, for example, Outlook for Mac or Mac OS X Mail, those cannot access legacy public folders if they are being moved to Exchange Server 2013. So they need to stay on the legacy server to be able to access those legacy public folders. So that's obviously something that Microsoft is working on, but as of today, this is the case. Outlook Web App. So before Exchange Server 2013, Service Pack 1, we couldn't access legacy public folders in OWA. Now we can. Outlook on Windows XP. Anyone use Windows XP still? Only like one hand. Nice. Maybe you don't dare to show it. Yeah? So if you are running Outlook, any version of Outlook on Windows XP, you cannot access legacy public folders unless you're on Service Pack 1 on Exchange Server 2013. Before that, didn't work. So kind of nasty things. So the two in the bottom are solved in Service Pack 1, but the one in the top are not solved yet. How about this one, huh? So how many attended Greg Taylor's session yesterday about this topic? Okay, just a few of you, okay. So this is kind of interesting. I myself are a big fan of TMG. I have been recommending TMG for my customers for years, you know. It feels very good to have that TMG in front. We do the pre-authentication, we do the Kerberos constraint delegation. It's kind of nice setup, makes us feel good, makes us feel safe. Yeah? But no, there's no TMG anymore, right? So we cannot buy it, at least. It's there. You could still download the trial and do it for 180 days. But the thing is, you cannot buy it anymore, and you cannot buy UAG either. That's gone as well. So Microsoft is moving away from these products, And we have now in Server 2012 R2 something called Web Application Proxy, which they are pointing to as a replacement for TMG and UAG. But as of today, the only thing you can reverse proxy with pre-authentication in that web application proxy, that's Outlook Web App. That's the only protocol you can pre-auth as of today. So it's not really a replacement for TMG yet, at least. So basically, if you want to do pre-auth, so we will talk about that in a bit. But if you want to do that, you are pretty much, you know, left out to hardware load balancers, for example. We have KEMP, we have F5. They can both do pre-authentication for Exchange, but very expensive stuff. Not KEMP are not that expensive. But still, so what we should argue or we should challenge this is that if we really need pre-authentication, that's what I'm getting at. So just because we did it in the past doesn't mean we have to do it today. So more and more customers, including some of our customers, are not doing pre-authentication anymore. They are just doing, you know, opening up the firewall into the load balancer, and that's it. And, you know, you have different systems. You have Link, for example. So if you use Link, you cannot do pre-authentication for Link. You have to publish your Link virtual directories without pre-authentication. It doesn't work anyway, otherwise. So if you do it for Link, why do you need it for Exchange? So I just want you to think about these things that you maybe don't have to do pre-authentication. So like I said, many customers just open up the firewall from the internet to the load balancer. And another thing, if you're doing Office 365 hybrid, you have to exclude your pre-authentication reverse proxy from doing pre-auth on EWS and AutoDiscover. So those two protocols need to be open, so to speak, without pre-authentication for Office 365 hybrid to work. So once again, okay, do we need it for the other virtual directories? Why do we do it? So I really recommend you to watch Greg's session on this topic, because it's very good, and it makes you think about if we really need it. So anyone on Exchange Server 2003? Any hands? I saw one, two, yeah, some, okay. So you cannot migrate directly from 2003 to 2013. That's impossible. The install will block you from that. You cannot even install 2013 if you have 2003 in your environment. So you will need to do a double hop migration. That's one option. You know, go to 2010 first and then go to 2013. It's going to be a big project, of course, because it's two migrations. But that's the option you have. Or you could actually do PST migration. So this is not nice, right? This is a manual process, and it's quite painful. But if it's a smaller environment, it could be an option. So we did one migration like this last year, from 2003 to 2013 with PST. And I want to point out one thing here as a pitfall, which is for you that isn't that had offices and users in a counter which isn't English speaking. For example, you might have users in Sweden, or you have them in the France or Netherlands or whatever, you know, non-English-speaking countries. So what Microsoft did is that they changed the translation of the standard folder names in Exchange Server 2013 for us that aren't English-speaking countries. So, for example, inbox in Swedish previous versions of Exchange was inkorgen. And in 2013, it's in Kori. As you can hear, even if you don't understand it, it's a completely different word, huh? So it's a new folder. So if we do normal migrations, it will work. There's no problem, because it's the default folder. So Exchange will map that when you do a real mailbox move. But if you do PST migration, that start mailbox import request doesn't understand that these folder names have been renamed. So you will get duplicate folders. You will have the inkorg and the inkorgen right next to each other. And that isn't that nice, right? So there's an awesome script created by an MVP that I used in this project. And it worked very well for this problem. So it actually merges these folders together for the mailbox that you have migrated. Okay, cross-forth migration. Nope, doesn't work either. They blocked that. But you can do from Exchange Server 2003 to Office 365. That will work. So that's the only way you can actually migrate, you know, in a real way, only one step. That's going to Office 365 from 2003. But there are also some third-party tools, for example, from Dell and other vendors that could take you directly from 2003 to 2013. Okay. Let's see how this goes. Okay, then I need to do something here as well. Okay, there we go. So, first of all, I would like to show you the OWASP silent redirect for 2007 mailboxes and the CAS switchover. So on this client, we have a user which has his mailbox on Exchange Server 2007. And the namespaces are still going to Exchange Server 2007. So this is the old OWASP form, like we recognize from the past. If I sign in here, I obviously get the 2007 version of OWASP. Okay, that's fine. So let's close this one. And before we actually move the namespaces, I would like to show you the configuration of these different virtual directories in all of these three Exchange versions that I have in this demo environment. So, oops. So I just did a simple little script showing all the virtual directories. Can you in the back see? Raise your hand. It's okay. No? Okay, let's do like this. So, this is the Exchange 2007 server and all the important virtual directories that we have from a CAS perspective. So first of all, we have OWASP, and we have the external URL being legacy.litware.nu/OWA. The ActiveSync URL is empty because we are doing proxy to 2007, so we don't need any legacy URL there. Don't put the legacy URL there, because then Exchange will try to do redirects. So that's how it works, at least if it's different from the 2013 server. And then we have the EWS, which also has a legacy URL, OAB as well. Outlook Anywhere is configured with NTLM. And our Autodiscover SCP is configured against autodiscover.litware.nu. So this is a namespace that we will change to 2013, as well as mail. So that was 2007. Then do the same thing on 2010. So what we've done here on 2010 is that we put all the URLs the same as they are in 2013. So you can do two options here. You can either leave them the external URL blank, and it will proxy. Or you can put the external URL the same as you have in 2013, and it will still proxy. But if you put something else here, something different, then it will try to do a redirect. So either the same or empty. So as you can see, it's the same flow for everything here, because we said 2010, everything is proxy. So we're using the same URL all the way. And the SCP is also pointing to autodiscover.litware.nu. Okay. And then last but not least, I will also show you 2013. Hopefully. Let's try the other side. Okay, there we go. So as you can see, this looks exactly the same as the 2010 server. And that's because we do proxy for everything. So it's exactly the same. It's one little thing here which we will look at in a bit, and that's the authentication methods, right, for Outlook Anywhere that we talked about. So let's change these namespaces. So right now, mail.litware.nu and autodiscover is pointing to 2007. So I will change that to go to 2013 instead. So this is a VIP running on my load balancer. So I changed mail and I changed Auto Discover. As you can see, legacy is still going to 2007, and that's how it's supposed to be. So I didn't need to flush DNS. So we now get the new 2013 version of the OWA form, right? So this is a difference because we changed this DNS record. So this is same user, I sign in, and I get 2007 Outlook web app, silent, single sign-on, redirect. So that's really nice, I would say. Okay, let's move on to the next, or maybe the first problem, actually. So we will go to this server, this client. Here we have another user, and this user has its mailbox on 2013, but it also connected a shared mailbox, which is on 2007. So let's open up Outlook here and see what happens. Boom. Authentication prompt. So this is the problem I told you about where we had negotiate as authentication method on Outlook Anywhere in 2013 and something different in 2007 in this case. So I could try to enter the password here, and it wouldn't work. And the reason for this prompt, it's because we have this, and it actually worked now. What? No, there's no items. So, but it's still prompt for password, as you can see. So let's try to fix this. So we will move to Exchange Server 2013, Exchange Admin Center. So here we have all our servers. And if we go into the first server here, we go to Outlook Anywhere. And here you can see that we have this negotiate as an authentication method for external clients. And this actually affects internal clients as well. So we will change this to NTLM. And we will do it on the second 2013 server as well, because they are load balanced, so we could hit any of those two. And then, so this is a demo, right? So we need to have things moving on pretty fast. So we need to do an IIS reset to get this to work right away. And I will actually do a normal IIS reset without no force. So, and this is because we need to have Auto Discover on 2013 to pick up this change. This is normally something that happens, you know, in the background. So if you just wait a couple of minutes, it will work automatically. But now I will do an IIS reset to have it going directly. So it's done on the second server, and it's done on the first server. There we go. Now I will also do a repair of the Outlook profile. And this is normally not required, but this is also because we want it to have it happen now, because Auto Discover and Outlook, they are not best friends, to be honest. You could, you know, be forced to wait for hours before it actually kicks in automatically. But it will eventually. So this is something, if you think about this in your real environment, this is something you will do before you start migrating users. Now we have an error already. So if this was in a real environment, we would move the user back instead of fiddling with this while he was on. So I will go into my email account. I will do repair of my profile. And this forces the client to do a new Auto Discover and actually receiving these settings from Exchange and get these new authentication methods, and hopefully then it will work. And I'm going to be honest with you, because I've rehearsed these demos and sometimes it just doesn't work right away, so we will see. Hopefully it will. So this is a good way of troubleshooting this. So what I will do now is I will go into Auto Discover configuration. And I will do a test of Auto Discover. And I will take a look on this XML response that I get back from Auto Discover. And I want to see which authentication it has sent me. this is probably pretty hard to see for you. But it has sent authentication package NTLM. So if you do like this, it says NTLM. So it should actually work. So let's try this. Okay, let's see if it accepts the password. It did. Okay. So it accepted the password, which it didn't do before. So if we now try to close it and try it again, hopefully it doesn't ask for password. Okay, there we go. So a little fiddling, but this is because it's a demo environment and AutoDiscover and Outlook, it isn't perfect. So, but in a real environment, you would, you know, do this ahead of time before you start migrating users, right? Okay, so third demo. We have a user now which has its mailbox on Exchange Server 2010. And this 2010 server has a CAS array which is configured as mail.litware.new. The same URL as we are using for Outlook Web App. The same URL that we just moved to Exchange Server 2013. So I'm going to show you this ambiguous URL problem. So if I start Outlook here, so right away we get a exclamation mark on the Outlook icon. If I do connection status, we can see that the client is trying to connect to mail.litware.new over RPC TCP. Okay? So this is a 2010 mailbox using a CAS array called that name. It's trying to use RPC TCP. And the CAS in 2013 will never allow that. So eventually, the Outlook client will fail over to HTTPS, but still the client experience is horrible in that way. It hangs and it freezes, not responding and everything. So you really need to do something about this. So there you go. That's RPC HTTP. But still you see it's connecting, so it's acting really, really bad. So we will close this one, and we will do another change. And this change we will do on the Exchange 2010 servers. So we will do a change on the Outlook provider. So these are the providers that AutoDiscover uses when it sends information to the Outlook client. So this is the, I will show you later, the use HTTP first on fast networks, or what is it called. So this is what I will set here during with PowerShell. So these are global configuration. This is nothing specific to a specific version. So this is a global configuration, as you can see. I don't specify a server name here. It's very global. And I will tell this Outlook provider that use HTTPS before you try RPC, basically. That's what I do. So we will do IIS reset. And we need to do it on the second 2010 server as well. And one might think here, why is he doing this on 2010? He moved the namespace to 2013. Isn't AutoDiscover being used from 2013? No, because we have that proxy I told you about earlier. So AutoDiscover is being proxied from CAS 2013 to CAS in 2010. So that's why I'm doing IIS reset in 2010. Because that's the AutoDiscover engine that needs to pick up this change. So once again, I will try to do a repair of the profile to have this kick in immediately. And then we will see what it does. Oh, yeah. So hopefully it should be HTTP now. No. So let's do the same thing again, because this is the problem with a demo like this. It's going too fast. That's the problem. And AutoDiscover needs its time. And also Outlook needs its time. So let's have a look here again and see if we got the server exclusive connect response from AutoDiscover. Okay. Oh, I need to move, sorry. I need to find it. Okay, we got it here. So, as you can see, server exclusive connect on. So what does that mean? Why is Outlook still trying RPC HTTP? Yes, because Outlook hasn't obeyed the auto discover response. That's basically what we see all the time. So this test is actually sending a connection to Exchange and saying, hey, give me the auto discover response for this user. But Outlook hasn't, you know, configured itself based on those settings yet. So let's try to do one more repair and see if that helps, or else I will do the change manually. Okay, let's see. This looks better. Boom, there we go. So now the client is connecting over HTTP directly. And what we basically did with that PowerShell command is manipulating this little checkbox that I will show you here now in the Outlook profile. So if we dig ourselves in here in the Outlook profile, we go to Exchange Proxy Settings, and there's a checkbox there saying on fast networks, connect using HTTP first, then connect using TCP/IP. That's what we manipulated with that provider flag in PowerShell. So we checked that box, you can basically say. But we did it in Exchange, Auto Discovery updated itself after the IIS reset, and then eventually Outlook picked up these settings and checked the box for us. So that's what we did. So now all Exchange 2010 mailboxes are using HTTPS, Outlook Anywhere, even internally, and we can safely switch over the namespace to 2013, and they will be happily connected to Exchange 2010. So the question was, would it make sense to do this tomorrow, even if you're migrating in like 3 months? Yeah, why not? There's a difference, though. So you are changing the way that clients are connecting to Exchange 2010. So earlier it was RPC, and now it's HTTPS. So there, maybe you are using, you know, riverbed optimizers, things like that. Things you might want to consider, because you're doing quite a big change. So what I want to say with that is, just don't do it like this without planning. But absolutely, you can do it, you know, tomorrow, if that's okay. So the question is, what's the downside of change to negotiate to NTLM? No, there's no downside really if you are not, you know, planning to do negotiate authentication like Kerberos, for example, in Exchange 2013. But you need to do that after your mailboxes is migrated, basically. So, I have some short slides here before we do the Q&A. This is probably ended by now, I guess. The garage here is down in the expo hall. I don't know if there's one more, maybe 2:30. There are some resources for you can use afterwards. The channel 9 is where you will find this presentation afterwards. It's being recorded, so you can find the entire session there, and also the PowerPoint slides. And then, please remember to fill out your evals. You can win a Xbox One. That's nice. And that's it. We will now take Q&A. Thank you. Yep.
You had a customer that you were doing 100 gigabyte mailboxes for. What was the target number of mailboxes per database and the target database size in those environments?
So I didn't hear that. Can you speak, either come up here or speak in the microphone?
Sure.
Yeah. I will repeat the question for the other words.
Okay. So, you said you had a customer that was doing 100 gigabyte mailbox.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the target number of mailboxes per database and the target database size?
So, the supported recommended maximum is 2 terabytes per database.
Is that the maximum or the default?
No, that's the recommended maximum. And I tend to recommend it to 1 terabyte. So in that case, about...
So you're doing 10 mailboxes per database?
Yes. Yes.
That's a lot of data.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Okay. Yep.
I have a question.
Yep. Okay.
From
Okay. So is this Exchange 2010 or 2010? Okay. So the question is about IOPS on the, as I understand you, the passive copies. Yeah.
What would you say? You haven't seen that? Because it's copying, you know, because it's not pure copy, like getting to the memory and working from memory. That would be great.
Yep.
But it's not doing just that. It's also copy data all the time.
Yep.
And reading on the long drive.
Yep. So in Exchange 2010, the IOP requirement on the passive nodes was passive copies was exactly the same as the active copy. So if you required, 1,000 IOP on the primary server, you needed that on the passive server as well, because of replication, because of background database maintenance, etc. So in 2013, that has gone down on the passive copy. So initially, they said it was 50% of the active copy. So maybe it's not exactly 50%, but it's around there. So therefore, we can put additional copies on the same JBOD volume. That's kind of the reason for that. But what I would like to add is that you need to calculate for your IOPS before you do your implementation. So that is something the Mailbox Role Calculator can help you with, which you can download. It's an awesome tool to help you plan the correct environment. So you will put in all this data in there, how large your mailboxes will be, how much you want the database size to be. That's also a parameter in there. You can modify that. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So with those tools, I have never seen problems when following those tools, basically. And also, what I would like to add is that you should use YetStress on your environment before you deploy Exchange on it. So you actually validate your storage and your drivers and everything, so you actually get the IOPS that you require.
Well, the problem is that tool, I can tell you what the problem is.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, so that's the biggest concern I have with running in SAN, because you say, I require this amount of IOPS. And they say, yeah, fine. It's okay. We have a lot of drives here. But they say that to all systems. They say that to all the systems that uses this SAN. And that's the problem. And your Exchange environment will hurt of it. So, and that's like the biggest reason to use local drives. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
From a business case perspective, how did you justify being able to allocate 1 terabyte for a database that maybe when you finish migration is only 250 gigs?
Yeah, so many customers, they yes, I understand, yeah. And that discussion is quite common. And it's okay to use like an average mailbox size instead of using the actual quota, but it requires good operations and good monitoring of your environment. But absolutely, that's what many customers do, to be honest. Yeah, so they use the average mailbox size instead and actually put more than 10 users in the mailbox. Yeah, so. Yeah, and that's the problem. That's the problem. So from my point of view, I would like to, only to plan for, from the beginning, to only utilize like 10%. That feels good, because you could never hit the wall.
Right, well, so in that case, that kind of makes the argument for statement,
Yep.
Or even going out and adding new shells to a compute node to continue your JMOD to be next to your data. Like moving from the data.
Yep. Yeah, I hear you. But the negative sides of the SAN with like the gentleman here told us about and other things are, you know, kind of making it harder to justify SAN as I see it. Because, and also, the drives are expensive. So, what? That's what customers say to me. So if they say, I want to put it on the SAN, and they say, and I say, okay, we will utilize this amount of data. They say, no, you cannot get that much data. We will give the users 1 gig of quota because the SAN storage is so expensive. That's what I get all the time. I think, yeah. So I don't know on the top of my head what the difference is, but I know that the calculator calculates with it. So you can, yes. So I don't know how much, but it will. So that's the nice part of having multiple copies per JBOD volume in 2013, because we could reseed from several disks at the same time. No. Yeah. Over the local network. Yes, absolutely. But it takes a couple of hours. So I think if you lose one drive and you had four drives on it, you will see like 8-9 hours or something, I think, like that. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And you could decrease that time because you can source from more drives at the same time. So if you lose one of those JBOD drives and you had four copies on that, you could. Yes. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
What does
Well,
can I ask a quick question while your guys are thinking that out? Just a quick question.
Yep. Okay.
That's why you guys sort out your SAN problems.
Yeah, we can talk more later.
Yeah, if I can move away from SanDisk and have bigger mailboxes, are people starting to request the need for third-party archiving tools?
No.
Nope.
Did you say start to request third-party archiving?
Yeah, start to request, you know, question whether they need them or not.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I thought you said request. Okay, so yes, when you do large mailboxes, there's really no need for third-party archiving as I see it. So I had a discussion on the booth yesterday with a gentleman from a healthcare industry, and he was saying we have this third-party archiving system, and I want to move away from it. I want to put it into Exchange. And that's what we see more and more customers doing, because there's really no, you know, sense of having it in a different system, which you have to take care of, backup, and everything. So the only, you know, objection to that would be for compliance reasons. So, but then I would say use the e-discovery things that are new in 2013 and use in-place hold with keyword search and specific users you could, you know, keep forever instead of keeping everything for everyone forever. So, yes. Thank you.
What about the limitations of number of items?
Yeah.
From what I've heard, it's still there. Like,
Yeah, but in 2013, it's a couple of millions, if I remember correctly. Yeah. It's a couple of millions. Yeah. So they. I think both. You need both. Which one? Ah. I recall that Ross had this session at MEC where he put up like 1,000 different boxes with new things, and that was one of them. And I think it, yeah, like all those values were blown away. Like, yeah. Yeah. So, but I'm not completely sure if, to be honest.
We've got a 2010-based exchange hybrid with Office 365 with shared domain, federation, basically all the complexity you could put into it. Any gotchas with upgrading to 2013 on-premise that you run into?
Yes. you could end up having a problem. I did a migration like that a couple of months ago. And so what you do is you introduce 2013, and you run this hybrid wizard again. And hopefully it will just work when you run the hybrid wizard from 2013, but it could still throw an error, which it did for me. And what I had to do, remove hybrid configuration from the 2010 environment and then run it in 2013 again. So, but that's the solution if you get a, I don't remember the exact error, but it was kind of like unhandled exceptions, thrown an exception, something like that.
So you had to manually remove it, because I don't believe there's a supported way of removing a hybrid in 2010.
So there's a commandlet introduced in Exchange 2013 called remove hybrid configuration. And I, if I recall correctly, that was what I ran in 2013, and it removed the 2010 stuff, basically.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
So I have a much simpler setup here.
Okay.
I have two VMs running, one CAS, one hub, and 100 mailboxes. 1 gig mailboxes. So, did I understand correctly when I go to 2013, I could do one VM for this, or should I keep those two separate VMs?
So today you have one CAS as a VM and one mailbox as a VM.
Yeah.
No, you should do one.
Just do one.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So no need for two servers, as long as you don't want redundancy or something, and build a DAG or something.
But yeah.
Otherwise, it's fine with one. Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
No problem.
What about cross-forest moves?
Yep.
Or auto-discover? Can you do 2013 auto-discover, refer back to 2007, cross-forest?
Yeah, you can still do the export auto-discover configuration between the forests, yes.
That won't cause a problem going 2007, 2013? So the only problem we've got is really the public folders then, right?
Yes, what I'm aware of, yes. Do you have a question as well? Not supported at the moment. Well, there's active discussions going on there, but nothing supported. Yeah, you can do it, obviously, yeah. One more time? No. So what that comes from, it wasn't a requirement in 2010 either. So what it comes from is that if you want to use Windows NLB as your load balancer, then you have to do CAS separately. But stay away from that one. It's not good. Okay. I would almost argue that's better than Windows NLB now. But what? Okay. Yeah, so if you want to utilize Windows NLB, you will still do separate cache servers because you cannot install Windows NLB on a server running on in a DAG. Yep. Not yet, to be honest. Anyone else of my friends here? No?